Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. I am Zach Weaver, and you are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 14, Episode 25, the West Memphis 3 Arkansas Supreme Court ruling. This week, Bob was joined by Bob and Allison Mata from the Defense Diaries podcast to discuss the breakdown of the Arkansas Supreme Court's ruling that was handed down. Today, I'm joined by Bob Ruff and Janet Varney. We have a lot to discuss, but before we get into that, let's tackle some housekeeping.
So for starters, I want to remind everybody and give you all the information about the podcast festival in the Berkshires that's coming up in October. It's selling out pretty quickly. It's going to be amazing. Let me read you the promo for you guys. So this October, I'm going to be meeting up with some of my favorite podcasts for Peak Fall Foliage. Sorry, Josh. In beautiful Berkshire County, Massachusetts. And I want you to join me. I should be clear. Josh wrote promo copy for me for this, but all the information's in there, so ignore my terrible delivery of it. I'll be live in the Berkshire Podcast Festival October 19th in North Adams, Massachusetts for an incredible podcast event and live show featuring tons of podcasts, including Justin from Generation Y is going to be there. Of course, Josh from True Crime BS. We're going to be there. Dr. Scott and Dr. Shiloh from the LA Not So Confidential podcast are going to be there. Already Gone, Bob Mata, and I think Allie's coming too from Defense Diaries is going to be there. And Josh's other shows are going to be featured on Safe Spaces, Our Americana. So there's going to be a ton of awesome people at this festival.
What about that other one show that's going to be there, Bob?
The JV Club podcast.
Damn.
Yeah. So Janet will be there both representing Truth and Justice and the JV Club, which, by the way, if you guys aren't listening to the JV Club, you should check out Janet's podcast.
So good.
The Berkshires are conveniently located in Western Massachusetts, just a quick trip from Albany, Boston, New York City, Montreal, and Philadelphia. Come explore world-class museums, the birthplace of farm-to-table dining, and the epicenter of the Gilded Age. And then soak up the sounds of some of your favorite podcasts for this weekend-long event. To buy tickets, and I will put this link in the description, and see who's coming and learn more about the Berkshires, go to BerkshirePodcastFestival.com. That's Berkshire, not with an S at the end, just the singular Berkshire, BerkshirePodcastFestival.com. Get your tickets. And in all seriousness, I hope you guys all get tickets. Zach and Michelle are going to be there. Becky and I are going to be there. JV and Brandon are going to be there. In a whole list of some of your other favorite podcasters. Janet's got some great Joni Mitchell tickets for sale that happen to be. So if you're in LA and you can't go to the Berkshires, but you'd like to see Joni Mitchell, reach out to Janet. She'll make you a deal. She's offered an in-person meet and greet with autographs from all your favorite podcasters and sketch artists and comedians and actors. She'll get you Seth Rogen's autograph.
It had to be Seth, huh? Yeah. He's pretty shy.
I'm sure you can pull it off.
Yeah. Okay.
Make sure that, and really, it's going to be all Josh had to say to me was Berkshire's in, you know, the second part of October, and I'm in. It's beautiful there. So if you at all have any option or any possibility of making it, go to BerkshirePodcastFestival.com for that. And for our patrons, there is a special promo code for our patrons. So if you are listening to this and you haven't checked out the pregame episode, or on Friday will be the Patreon Hour video version, we do give you to our patrons that special patron only promo code for 35% off tickets. So make sure you check that out.
35% off is a lot.
Yep. All right. So with the fun out of the way, we've got some not so fun stuff. So back to in season 13, you guys remember the Kaylana Turner case? That was one of, it's interesting. We've had developments in two of the cases of all the missing persons cases we did that I was really like really dug into and was like pulling maps and really talking to the families. And in one case, even talking to law enforcement, because it just seemed like, in Kaylana's case, if you recall, she was the one where, she had, I don't remember exactly what condition she had, but she had medications that caused her personality to change a bit. She had pulled into some neighborhood. The police ended up chasing her in her car. When they finally caught up to her car, it was stuck in some mud near a creek, and then she was just gone. And they, you know, months had gone by and they've been searching for her and had never been able to find her. They were having issues in gaining access to search all the places around. There's a lot of private property. I do regret to inform you that Kaylana's body has been found. So on one hand, there's some closure. We know what happened. I don't have many details other than the articles I read said that her body was found in pretty close proximity to where she was last seen, which would be where her car was. So it seems like she was, you know, she had ran. Remember, she was barefoot. She didn't have her shoes on. Yeah. It was cold. So somewhere out there, I'm assuming in those woods. And if you got into that case and you looked at the maps, there was just forever, just thick woods that went on for a long ways. So at least there is some closure there. Her body was found. And then we have the Alex Jackson case, which we did discuss last week or the week before, that there was an arrest. His friend Joe was arrested for Alex's murder. We didn't have any details on that. And then I believe it was yesterday, there was two news events in this case that came out, boom, boom, one right after the other. So Joe's, I think it's Shute is his last name.
I think so, yeah.
His attorney filed a motion to dismiss the case, citing the fact that they hadn't found the body. And so without them having a body, they couldn't prove that Joe had murdered Alex. And then, at least in my feed, maybe there was more of a gap, but when it hit my feed when I saw it, an hour later, it was announced that Alex's remains were, in fact, found.
Mm.
So we don't know much about it, but there was a little bit of information that was kind of put out in the article. It did say that someone had told police that Joe had admitted to murdering Alex to them. So that seems to be at least some of the probable cause that led to his arrest, mm-hmm. that he had supposedly or allegedly confessed to someone that he had murdered Alex. And then they ended up finding his body. They found remains. It's been over 400 days. They found remains in New Hampshire, which is, you know, not terribly far away, but it's a little poke away from where they were at in southern Maine. They found human remains. They had to the medical examiner do the autopsy on that, and they were then able to identify those remains as belonging to Alex. So. Still more information to come out about this, and as more comes out, we'll share it with you. Because the fact that it seems like they found the remains in somewhere obviously that was somewhat hidden shortly after the arrest would kind of indicate that maybe there was, as part of the he confessed to me, there was probably, or I should not should say probably, possibly. Maybe some information about the location and where he put the body, because after 400 days, as soon as he's arrested, boom, they find the body.
Mm.
So more updates on that as we go. But so we do have some closure in both of those cases, and sadly, not a happy ending to either one of them.
Yeah.
And with that said, we'll get right into this one. I see, we got Bob Mata is in the chat. He says, what's up? He says, hey, y'all. And I do want to star one of these questions in case we don't get to it that somebody asked in the live chat. So I can ask that later. So I guess we'll get started. We'll go with Zach first. What did you think of the episode and the conclusions that were shared?
It was great to actually hear everything broke down. Bob and Allison did a phenomenal job breaking down not only the ruling, but the dissent, which was great. They brought up a lot of concerns that I had. I mean, I'm a long time advocate for this case. I have their back all the time. I've become friends with Damien. And there's definitely some issues that I was worried about that they kind of discussed in the episode. So it felt a little better that I wasn't being crazy, that these are legitimate concerns, you know, just the fact that when it came out, everybody was so excited. Everybody was so excited that they're like, we have this ruling for testing, and that's really not the thing. It's really not ruling for testing.
Right.
It's ruling that they have to now judge on the merit.
Yeah. Essentially, they said that the judge punted it
mm-hmm.
and said, nope, this isn't even my jurisdiction. And then the court kicked it right back and said, yes, it is. You need to hear this case.
Which is still absolutely phenomenal. We're moving forward. We're taking big leaps, and it's going to be great. But we still have to go back. We still have to fight. But to hear Bob and Allison break it down, it was extremely nice to hear, especially because I'm an average Joe. I these legal documents are confusing sometimes. So sometimes the way they're worded is just not able to be processed by me.
Yeah.
So it was nice to hear them break it down.
Yeah, absolutely. Janet, what'd you think?
I mean, I thought it was great. And I agree with everything that Zach said. You know, one of the things that I enjoy so much about Bob and Allie is that they don't pull their punches. They are right there to say, look, we've been doing this for a really long time. Obviously, you take your victories where they happen, whether they are small, but meaningful, because, you know, I think back to what you guys went through when you went all the way out there to West Memphis, and to be treated so poorly, to be dismissed so quickly, to have of all of the things you expected, you did not expect to have the judge just be like, not my problem, bye, you know, yeah. And that was just so disrespectful. And so I think it's still, you know, a great thing to be able to take the victory of, you know what, you guys were right, that judge sucked. And, you know, we have evidence showing that you're not the only ones who felt that way and that that's true. And that being said, you take that victory and you also recognize, you know, which is what was so great about the breakdown and conversation is, you know, these are the things that we're still up against. This is I thought the dissent discussion was really important, really valuable. Mm-hmm. And it was so great to have it mm-hmm. broken down by people, you know, by all of you really being familiar with it and understanding it. And so, yeah, it was an incredibly helpful episode to kind of get caught up on all of that.
You know, the thing that you mentioned when you talk about the judge just punting it, and you both talked about it, is I was there, Bob was there the day of that trial. And that's not even something that I thought was even in the realm.
Well, nobody did, because for most people that are familiar with the, and actually for the, on Sunday, I have an interview coming out with, Robbie Chowdhury and Colin Miller. And we actually talked a little bit about this this morning, too, in the fact that if that was the intention, most of the attorneys that we have spoke to about this would have expected like a summary judgment. Like, they wouldn't have ordered oral arguments and had people try. I mean, as far as advocates and supporters, there are people that flew from around the world. People from Europe came to be at this hearing to support mm-hmm. them. We also paid thousands of dollars for an expert witness to testify. And so that we never occurred to us that it was going to be, you know, this dismissal from the bench, because if that was going to be the case, we would have expected that to have come in a written order before that.
We were, you know, we've told the story. You can find it on here. We won't go over it a million times, but obviously we were forced to be in the parking lot. We weren't allowed to be in the courtroom, and they came out within 15, 20 minutes. And we were all like, holy shit. Like,
we thought the prosecutor joined the motion.
Yeah, because why else would they be out so quickly? And then I just remember we ran over there because we were excited, and they're like, they won't hear it. Mm. Yeah. Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah. It was crazy. I remember Mara Leverett coming out and just looking at me, and she just shook her head. Mm. I was like, wait, that can't be good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, of course, out of that, we have a lot of questions about, you know, what comes next. And I think maybe some people who are looking for some further clarification, or, you know, just wanting to have a sense of moving forward, like timelines and all that kind of stuff. So we definitely had a lot of engagement in the Facebook group about this. You want to jump in?
Yeah, let's jump right into the questions. I do want to point out Great Bambino in the chat. I did star your earlier question regarding that. And so we will definitely cover that. Thank you.
Great. Well, I just wanted to start with Hope's comment because, you know, I try to put things in a little bit of order, but this one was just something that I wanted to get out of the way early, in the sense that it's so infuriating. And I know you guys talked about it some. I think you also talked about it with Rabia and Colin today. As I remember, if you're a patron, you can check out that conversation on Patreon already. It will be there for you. Hope says, I cannot get over the state Supreme Court judge literally calling Damien a murderer in a legal document. I personally believe that Damien's innocent, along with Jesse and Jason. And once it's proven, can there be any repercussions for that judge, maybe based around slander or libel? So irresponsible of a judge to use that type of terminology towards someone that has maintained their innocence for decades.
No, I mean, I think as a non-lawyer, it's very unprofessional. We didn't, of course, we discussed that with Bob and Allie as well. But the problem is, as of right now, Damien is a convicted murderer.
Right.
So it's not slander for the judge or anyone to call him a murderer right now. Including that in that document and saying it like it. To me, what it did is it just revealed just the absolute bias.
Sure.
In the whole thing. I mean, as I've said before, in this case, similar to Adnan's case, if you are looking at this case and everything that's come out, and you are still dug in 100%, these are the guys, like, you're just not being intellectually honest. Now, I'm not saying that you have to agree that they're innocent, but if you're looking objectively at the evidence that's been put out there, I mean, think about this. The case in chief that was presented by the prosecution at the time of trial, a large majority of that has been completely debunked. You know, witnesses who have recanted, like the evidence that was used to convict them has been debunked. Expert after expert after expert, with Jesse's confession, which wasn't even part of their trial, wasn't supposed to be. The jury was considering it, but that's a whole other discussion. The wounds on the bodies being post-mortem, all the witnesses recanting, all these things. And so, like, it just to reveal bias is in cognitive dissonance is the fact that you've already drawn your conclusion. So when the data changes, you're just continually trying to pivot your argument to still land on your foregone conclusion. And the reality is, I think that my position is I believe that they're innocent, but I want this testing to, you know, and if this testing comes back and it shows Damien Eccles' DNA is on those knots, then Damien did it. I was wrong. And he did it. I certainly don't think that's going to be the case. I'm almost 100% convinced that's not going to be the case. I mean, I personally am 100% convinced that's not going to be the case, but I'm still open to the possibility. And there are so many people out there that are just so dug in that they can't even admit that maybe there's some question here. And that's what I see bleeding through from that judge when she writes, paraphrasing, it's a fruitless attempt to exonerate a depraved murderer. Like, they already have this foregone conclusion. And also, keep in mind, I'm not getting into any kind of politics here, but what I will tell you is that the person who wrote the dissent was appointed by the current governor down there, and this is why your votes matter. That, you know, it was a 4-3 decision. The person who wrote the dissent, if I from my research, that's what it seemed like. It's one of the newer justices that was appointed by the latest governor there, and so it matters. Just keep in mind, your vote not only for the district attorney, your votes for the governor, all those things matter, and then they have real life consequences, like we're seeing here.
Yeah, and just to emphasize, yeah, the people in the chat are really, they're really calling out. You know, convicted murderer, sure, okay, depraved. Is that a legal term? Is that something you can throw in and say, yes, this has been proven? Let's jump to this question from Ashley, who said, can the Arkansas governor provide any assistance with this case, since you just mentioned that in a very specific context?
I would certainly not expect that from that governor.
Yeah. Well,
to answer the question, yes. I mean, a governor could grant clemency to it, but I would certainly not expect that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a second about the prosecutor. Larry says, y'all talked a bit about the new prosecutor. Did you know this about her background? And then he included a link in an interview where she talked about representing a kid she knew was innocent but couldn't save. That's available to read on the Facebook page. We can read bits of it if we have time. I'm not sure we do. But it certainly would suggest that this is somebody who might lean, and I know it's so hard to know or say, based on that, but that is sort of putting themselves out there to be concerned with actual innocence in some way.
Keep in mind, I'm not looking for someone that's like on the defense side. I'm looking for someone that will be neutral and will seek the truth. That's it. That's all we're asking for. You know, and again, like the whole fight over this is bananas. We're not asking. Damien has not filed a motion, as we said in the episode, requesting for his conviction to be overturned. He's filed a motion asking to do testing that was not available in the past so that we can get more information, so that then if we find more information there, then we might be able to overturn this conviction. And more importantly, then we might be able to find out who actually murdered Michael, Stevie, and Christopher.
Right.
Anybody that wants to know the truth, this is the logical next step for anybody that wants to know the truth.
Yeah.
Regardless of what side of the fence you stand on, we can find the truth by this. Yeah. If you think they're guilty, then this testing is going to prove that they're guilty.
Right.
If you think they're innocent, this testing can prove that they're innocent. You know, we need to find the truth.
Yeah. And again, if they're so sure, especially because we're funding it, like there's no downside in the, not the real world's not the word I'm looking, but practically speaking, there's no downside to doing this testing. It's not costing them anything. If they're so sure Damien did it, they should be saying, fine, go do the testing. Then you'll find his DNA there and you'll shut the hell up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they're not doing that. They're terrified to find the testing because in the real world, they're terrified to be exposed for what they did to them, you know, with surety to find out what exactly happened in this case and how they destroyed the lives or made a valid attempt to destroy the lives of three teenagers. And that's the fight. But again, I cannot stress enough. I'm not lumping in the new district attorney into that because she has given us no reason to do that yet. So I want to give her the benefit of the doubt, remain optimistic, because I think that any legitimate prosecutor that is legitimately seeking to find the truth and justice would join this motion. So that's my hope, is that that's what we get from her.
Yeah. Well, Kim says, just looking for a little more clarification, Kim says, why does there have to be a new hearing? Why can't the judges just rule on the merits of the previous hearing now that they know their jurisdiction ruling was wrong? Maybe I'm not remembering what happened at the previous hearing correctly.
Well, they never heard the merits. So that's the thing. We went there and I don't know what the prosecution had, but on Damien's side, they had their case laid out. We had expert witnesses waiting to testify. We were there to present the reasons why the testing should be approved. And they walked into the courtroom, and before anybody got to present any evidence or any merits to be weighed, the judge just said, you're not in custody. This is a habeas rule. Therefore, you're not entitled to it. And I'm not ruling on it. And that was it. They were in and out. They never actually got to argue any of it. So the judge hasn't heard any of those arguments yet.
Right. Okay. And then Sarah says, if the testing were to get approved and was completed, then what would the next steps be? Does a new investigation just begin and they're exonerated, or do they go back to trial and enter a plea of innocence? What would the timeline look like? Veronica also asked kind of a similar question. And Amanda is, you know, feeling a little disheartened thinking about it going back to the same court. That's something you guys certainly touched on, that kind of came into play with the discussion about the dissent and the reasoning behind the dissent and all of that. Tanya wants to know if it'll be the same judge. I lumped all of those together because it's sort of what now kind of question.
Okay. So I will rely, Bob Mata is in the chat. So Bob, if I get something wrong, please feel free to chime in. But so this is how things work. So it's been remanded back to the court. Ideal scenario, the new DA says, I'm just going to join in the motion and we're going to present to the judge. We both sides want to do this testing. We do the testing. If that doesn't happen, if they still oppose it, then the original filings go back to the judge. They schedule oral arguments again, and we go in and then we make the case before the judge, and then the judge rules on it. Hopefully, second best scenario is the judge hears the arguments and approves the testing. One thing that Bob noted in the podcast, in the episode this weekend, is that this case has been kicked all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the district attorney in this case has been smacked back down regarding testing over and over and over and over and over again. So that judge has to know that if they make the argument and the judge says, nope, I'm still not approving the testing, it will get appealed again. And there's a good chance that then the Supreme Court will overturn that ruling and send it back, or a higher appellate court. But generally, this case has always ended up at the Arkansas Supreme Court. And regarding testing of evidence, the Supreme Court of Arkansas has always sent it back and told them to do the testing. So hopefully, in one of those scenarios, either they join the motion, we win at the oral arguments, or we lose, it gets appealed, and if at some point the testing gets approved, then the evidence goes out. They're going to do the testing, And as far as what happened next, that all depends on the results, right? So let's say, best case scenario, they find the same person's skin cells inside every one of those 12 knots. That's pretty damn conclusive evidence. But then it's everything's still not a guarantee. And this is another reason why I'm glad we have a new DA there, someone who I'm hoping will look at this objectively. In the perfect world, a district attorney would see that and say, okay, well, that's our guy. These guys are innocent. And then they would join a motion to vacate Damian, Jesse, and Jason's conviction. And then at that point, it's an open case again. They would launch their investigation into this new person or make an arrest for this new person and start that process over with a new defendant. So that would be ideal. Or it could be, so let's say, for example, they find some of Terry Hobbs' skin cell, and I'm only using his name because he's already kind of mixed up in the binding piece because of the hair that was similar to his that was found, that he couldn't be ruled out from in the knot. So say they find Terry Hobbs' skin cell and in one or two or three in some of the knots. Now you're kind of, things are kind of up in the air a little bit because it all depends on the prosecutor. If they're inclined to uphold the current conviction, then Damian's team would then file a writ of actual innocence based on this new evidence. The state would then fight that, probably claiming that's probably transfer DNA. The boys were in his house that day. And then that would go back before this judge. I think it would be the same judge again. And then they would argue that out there. And if that's denied, then of course that can get appealed up and beyond there. So those are some of the possibilities. Or another real possibility is we do the tests and it comes back and they say there's no usable DNA. And then that's it. And truthfully, I believe that this is probably our last shot. I mean, MVAC DNA extraction is the best in the best possibility. It generally gets about 200 times more DNA than any other method out there. So if there is DNA present, it's going to find it and get it and extract it. If we use that method and there's just not, it's too degraded, there's not enough there, the water washed it away, whatever the case may be, there's probably not another possibility beyond there. That probably is just going to be game over and the case is going to sit where it sits. So I think that's pretty much a good wide look at all the different scenarios that could be playing out here.
Okay. I have a bunch of questions, but I also don't want to forget questions that have come through here. I'm just going to jump into Tanks really quickly, and I'm going to try to put a pin in my own questions and hope I don't forget them, which I probably will. Tank says, do we know exactly what articles of evidence would be available for MVAC testing? I know we've talked about this a little bit.
I believe they found pretty much everything. The one thing that I believe this particular motion requested specifically to test the knots and the bindings, the boys' bindings. So I think if this gets approved, that's what we'll get. And there's been some discussion, people are like, we should request to test everything and we should, you have to keep an ace in the hole in these cases, right? So if we request to test everything and it gets denied and it goes up to the Arkansas Supreme Court and they deny it, you're out of options then. It's over. But if you request to test just the bindings and say you don't get results from there, that still at least leaves the door open in the future to request tests of some other things that Suzanne Ryan from Pure Gold Forensics had suggested. She said she would still consider testing MVACing the clothes, even though they were buried down in the water. The sticks that were used to push the clothes and to pin the bodies down in the water, these are things that would take skin off. We landed on the bindings because she said the most likely place and the most conclusive place to find DNA that came from the killer would be in those knots. When you tie knots, you shed lots of skin cells. Also, because everything was exposed to the elements and it was in the water, because of the nature of a knot, the inside of the knot was protected from the water. So stuff wasn't going to just wash away from it. So we went with the bindings because that is the best high percentage chance of us finding not only finding DNA, but finding DNA of the killer.
And just to that point, just for clarification, Mischief in the chat says the DNA will only be tested against the three, the Westmovis three, as they're known. Can a defense paid test have access to any other DNA? Could it be run through CODIS? Like, how would all that work? How would you match DNA to someone who wasn't any of the three convicted?
Not the right one.
It will be compared to all known profiles. So as part of this case, we have known profiles from several other suspects. So it would be compared to, because, you know, the defense is going to get the results just like the prosecution is going to get the results. And, you know, the defense has all those profiles that have ever been attached to this case. So does the prosecution. So one side or the other, both most likely, will test it against known profiles. So beyond that, so say we get a solid profile and it's showing up on multiple bindings. And it's not Damien, Jason, Jesse. It's not any of the victims. It's not Terry Hobbs. It's not David Jacoby. It's not any of the people whose DNA is already a part of the case. Then the next step, which would hopefully wouldn't require court and motions, but that the prosecutor would just do it, would be to enter that DNA into CODIS and see if we can get a hit through CODIS to figure out who it is. So that's the next step, is once you extract it, if you get DNA, solid DNA profiles, then the next step is to figure out who they belong to. And then the next step is to figure out where we go in the case from there, depending on, you know, if that's done, and if so, who it belongs to.
Okay. I want to go back also a ways back in our chat to Tool Girl, who is, and I would love to hear from you, Bob Mata, if you want to contribute to this as well. Just in terms of, you know, Tool Girl says, I think they worry if the DNA shows the real killer, the state will be sued for the years the three were locked up. It's a financial thing, not just the DA covering their asses and reputation. So that takes us into this sort of existential place where we talk about it all the time on this podcast. Certainly Bob and Ali talk about it, where we're up against not just this case in particular, this evidence in particular, these personalities in particular, but also a system where there are so many reasons for a DA's office to point to, whether they're acknowledging it to the public or not, to sort of internally take an inventory and go, well, let's see, here's all of the incentives I have to not make this person innocent, to not vacate this conviction, to not. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I think Bob alluded to that on the episode Sunday, mm-hmm. where he said, you know, they're probably looking at millions of dollars in lawsuits at this. And I'm sure it's not like some states like Texas. Texas has a wrongful conviction statute that says, I'm working from memory, but I believe it is, if someone's conviction is overturned based on actual innocence, they are paid $80,000 a year, $80,000 for every year that they were incarcerated wrongfully, and then an additional, I want to say, $40,000 a year for the rest of their lives. And that's like set in stone. There doesn't have to be a lawsuit. If this happens, that's the result of it in Texas. In Arkansas, and someone can check me on this, but I believe when I looked at this years ago when we were working on the case, that there's never been.
They've never convicted an innocent person.
Yeah, right?
I think that's what they say. I'm putting that in giant sarcastic air quotes.
Yeah, they have never had an actual innocence exoneration in Arkansas, from my memory. Now, if somebody can check me on that, I'll be happy to correct that. But that's my understanding, is according to the state of Arkansas, never in the history of the state have they ever had a wrongful conviction. They've never convicted an innocent person who's then overturned on actual innocence.
Well, and you got to think of the monetary hit a state takes for one individual.
Right.
And this is three for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then also look at the other thing is, and by the way, Bob just said in the chat that that's definitely one of the many hurdles to overcome in terms of getting the state to admit to making a mistake. The other thing they have to look at is not how much money outflow might come in lawsuits, but on top of that, if they're exonerated based on actual innocence, they may not advertise this, but smart voters know. How many millions of dollars have they spent in the last 31 years both putting these three men into prison and then trying to keep them in prison and then trying to keep their conviction upheld after they were out of prison. All for three guys who were then in this world proven to be actually innocent the entire time. So it's not even just the outflows that are the future outflows. They have to justify. They've spent so much time, effort, and money keeping innocent people in prison. It's not a good look. And that's why it's so important to me that we have new guard in there, that we have a new DA without connections to, you know, that comes from the defense side and has no connections that we're aware of to the old guard. Because if she overturns the conviction and goes and prosecutes the correct person and puts him in prison, that doesn't look poorly on her at all, right? Because she had nothing to do with that nonsense for all those years. She came in with the white hat and finally fixed a 31-year injustice.
Right. And in response to that sort of financial question, I want to just shout out Bloom Tick Bloom, who even said, you know, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but if the actual innocence argument is the most important and the testing is the most important, is there a scenario in which, and no one's saying that this would be fair or that it makes sense, but is there a scenario in which you could sort of volunteer like, hey, we're not even going to come after you for money. We'll sign a document that says you don't owe us anything. Just make us innocent. Just, you know what I mean? Just exonerate us. Just let us walk away with actual innocence here. No one's saying, and no one in this chat is saying like, sounds great. They don't deserve anything. So they should, you know, offer that up. But is that even something that could be on the table?
There may be a world where that could happen, but I don't think it would, nor should it. You know, because on top of everything else, on top of the fact that they fucking owe these guys, I mean, these guys are still convicted murderers. They're out busting their asses, trying to make a living, trying to get by after spending, you know, losing those formative years of their lives while they're in prison, and then coming out and with convicted murderer on your resume isn't super helpful either. So that they deserve to be compensated for what happened to them. But beyond that, that just puts another asterisk on it, doesn't it? Right. So like if say that happens, they promise we won't sue if you overturned our conviction. And then the prosecutor's like, okay, we're going to overturn the conviction. They'll still be the same people for the rest of their lives. And that's a huge part of what they're dealing with. It's a huge part of what Damien deals with, that there's all these people that still believe that he is a murderer, that he murdered three kids, and they will use that to continue. So he doesn't, where does he get with that? Yeah, convicted murderers off his resume, but he still has, you know this percentage of the population that is forever going to call him a child murderer. And to be fair, even if we find the DNA and the person they find ends up confessing and everybody does it, there'll still be 1,000 people out there that'll still insist that they're guilty.
Gosh, I wish it were only 1,000 people. Yeah, and I would also say, too, and I think this is one of the things I also enjoy so much about Defense Diaries and what we do here, is this, the whole idea of law being so meaningful because it's setting precedents. And so what you also don't want is to have this sort of precedent set that's like, that you would dangle that, suddenly that would start getting dangled in front of other people who are claiming actual innocence. Like, well, I mean, we could talk about it if you're willing to just forgo any, you know, compensation. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That just feels like we're wading into this dangerous territory where it's like, wait a minute, why are the actually innocent people making all of the concessions and creating bigger and bigger and more hurdles that can be put in their way when all anybody's trying to do is right or wrong?
Yeah. And instead of doing that, I'll quote my friend Janet Varney, do your damn job.
You love how hot out of the collar I got that day.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yep.
Well, Terry says, is there anything we can do? Is it worth doing a respectful letter campaign to this new DA, asking her to consider looking further into the case and possibly joining the motion for testing? Or should we be patient and not rock the boat this time? And that's something that kind of similar thought that Kathy had.
At this point, I think we don't rock the boat. I think that we let's see what happens next. Now, and that being said, that, you know, if Damien's attorneys tell me, hey, we need to put some pressure, we need to let her know that people are watching, then I will certainly let you guys know. But, you know, this is all new right now. I think as hard as it is, I think that right now we need to see what this new prosecutor is all about and see where she goes with this. And believe me, I'm following every detail of every day of this case as it goes forward. And when the time comes that we need to rally the troops, then we will certainly do that. That's what got us here. You guys should all be very proud of yourselves, because that's what got us to where we're at now, was the pressure that you guys put on Scott Ellington after the Forgotten West Memphis 3 aired. At the end of that, when I put out the call to action to write letters, call, email, I've seen the emails from Ellington making very clear how disruptive that was to his office. And that is what got him originally to agree, okay, let's do it. And then this whole process that we're going through now. So when it's time to do that, we'll do that. But now is not the time to do it yet, because right now we have a new prosecutor, we've got new eyes on the case, and let's see what she's going to do with it.
Okay. Great. Of course, we have our test the fucking evidence hashtag that we've been reminded of by the great Bob Mata. So, yeah, test the evidence. I just want to shout out Jennifer Hill, our own Jennifer Hill, who has done so much work and invested so much blood, sweat, and tears into, I don't want to give anything away, but Jamie Snow is of course the person that she has been advocating so hard for, in addition to other folks. But this is a long post, Jennifer. I know that that when you made this long post, I was like, am I going to be able to read the whole thing? Will we have time? But drawing these parallels between arguments that were made in for both Damien and testing that DNA, and then the dissent that we saw coming from, well, listen, it wasn't, DNA wasn't a huge part of why they were convicted, so it just isn't going to matter. Can you guys just redress that again? I should say readdress. I think redress means that you're just talking down to it. But could you readdress that a little bit again, just to help those of us who are still feeling that nervousness about the dissent and what that could mean and why they would say, look, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Why would we test it? It doesn't even matter. It doesn't change anything.
Yeah. In this, that was the thing when we broke down, when Bob and Allie and I broke down that dissent, that argument doesn't hold water to me. I mean, even so, Allie was the least familiar with the case, but she could see the issues in it too. Bob's more familiar, and of course I know very well. The big flaw in that argument to me was the fact that they're saying that DNA testing wasn't part of the trial that convicted them, but that trial doesn't exist anymore. I don't even see how they made that argument. That conviction was overturned. It is no longer a standing conviction. It is no longer a standing trial. The only thing that we have on the record in Damien's case is simply the Alford plea. That's all that's there. And also, you have brand new technology, in the early 90s, when this case was being tried, DNA was around. It was kind of in its infancy as far as being used in court. It was early. A lot of people didn't fully understand it. They did try to do DNA testing in this case, if you recall. If anybody's read Dan Stidham's book, Harvest of Innocence, he talks about how John Fogelman, the prosecutor, lied to him and told him that they had found one of the victim's blood on a t-shirt found at Jesse Miss Kelly's house. I don't know if that story's been out. It's in the book. Again, highly recommend that book. But yeah, Fogelman told him that there was blood on a t-shirt at Jesse's house. They did DNA testing and it was one of the victims. So now, Dan thinks that he's working with a guilty client and is trying to figure out how to negotiate a plea deal. And then through his investigation, talking to Jesse, that didn't make any sense. And then literally the day they walk into court, Fogelman tells them, oh, actually, we made a mistake. That wasn't his. Ugh. So anyway,
despicable.
DNA testing was around then, but it was kind of in its infancy. And now we have this MVAC technology. It's technology that wasn't even dreamt about back then. So you certainly have new technology. They tried to frame it as though identity wasn't an issue. And they tried to, so why are we trying to identify who killed them when identity wasn't the issue? And they framed that by, because we know it was them, because we saw witnesses You know, we had witnesses who saw them near the crime scene, except for they've recanted, you know, the fiber evidence that's been debunked, you know. So I personally don't really have concerns with that. Bob and Allison both certainly pointed out some of the flaws in it. But then when you get deeper into the case and you understand that these things they're talking about don't actually exist in the case anymore, I don't think that those things that are we have the issue with. Jamie's case is a little different. Jamie's case was tough because it was there was some sign of struggle, but you know, the prosecution theory on the case is basically that Bill Little was shot, fell down. That's why the stool got knocked over and stuff. And so there's blood on, you know, that little bit of blood that was there. It was presumed that must have been Bill Little's, and that's kind of the argument they took there. I mean, granted, I believe that evidence should have been tested, but there are apples and oranges as far as the reasoning behind why testing them. Like, you can't make that argument when you know that you have a killer that tied knots binding victims, and we're trying to find out whose skin cells are in those knots. You can't really say, yeah, that would be irrelevant, even though they tried.
Well, Jamie Snow's case, the Bill Little case, also predates the West Memphis 3 by a couple years.
Right.
And during the West Memphis 3, no one knew about DNA testing. I mean, no one really knew about it until the OJ case, right? That's about the same timeline.
Well, yeah, and that was, 92? So it was out there.
OJ was 93, I believe.
Yeah,
but Bill Little's case was 91.
Right.
So you're still, saying that it's not used, if they don't know that they can't.
Well, they did. I don't believe they made that argument in Jamie's in denying his. In his, basically, they said, there's no reason to believe that's the killer's blood, essentially was the argument they made.
Yeah, I understand that. And I understand that, you know, me just wanting to stomp my feet and say that's not fair is like the saddest thing you could possibly attempt to do in this context, because that's not what the law is. It's not just someone saying this isn't fair. But, you know, Jennifer's point in making these comparisons were, you know, take a moment to look at all of the rest of the quote unquote evidence. And there is a lot of specious stuff there as well. There's a lot of stuff that starts to crumble. And anytime you have anything like that, as you were talking about, Bob, when you're looking at what cases you're going to choose, if you're looking closer and closer and it starts to crumble more and more, then when a person who is convicted is saying, I'm begging you to test this evidence, you would hope that someone would be weighing everything instead of just, you know, well, was it a factor before or not? And also, that just seems like you can't have it both ways. I mean, we use DNA to convict, we use DNA to exonerate, but in a situation where you have a person who has walked away, is walking free in the world, and is saying, test this evidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's hardly
that
someone
that should matter.
Yeah. Because it's hardly someone that is still incarcerated, because certainly this does happen where they're like,
or someone's looking for a Hail Mary pass. I get it.
Yeah. They're still in prison, even though maybe they are guilty, but maybe it won't be there. And they're just trying everything because hell, why not? It's a completely different story. As you pointed out, they're free. Like Damien's out. He can do whatever the hell he wants, but he's still saying, no, I don't, I want this concluded. I want justice for those boys. I want my name cleared. And I know that not only is my DNA not in there, but when he was told by an expert that the killer's DNA should be in those knots, then let's test those fucking knots.
Yeah. Well, and I think the conversation, the part of the conversation where you and Bob and Allie were talking about the families and, you know, the sort of tragedy of knowing that there are family members, and understandably, not everyone believes that it wasn't the three gentlemen we're talking about now, but we know that there are family members who did believe it. The tragedy of there not being the weight and the force behind being able to have families join in this argument when you know, it's they've publicly said, like, we know these are the wrong guys. That's hard.
I need to add to that. Like, I thought later, I didn't mention Ryan Clark, Christopher Byers' brother, also wants the DNA tested.
Yeah.
So that's just, and I know we're running long, so we got to speed up.
Well, I'm done. That was it for a question, so.
Okay, but the fact that they used the victims' families in the dissent as an excuse not to do this just infuriated me. Because it's like, you're not, the victims' family, there's court, it's not even just you didn't have to watch the documentary, there's court records where the victims' families have been fighting to find the truth out in this case. And then for you to be like, the way you read it, it's like, we don't want to open this wound for Pam Hicks and make her go through this all again. It's like, she's fucking begging for it.
Right.
She wants to know. She doesn't believe that those three killed her son, and she wants to know who did, and she wants them to pay for it. And so by citing their name, it just infuriated me. I do, before we close out, I promised the Great Bambino on YouTube, I starred their question, and I want to make sure I get to this. They asked, why is Damien pushing for DNA testing separately from Jason? From watching The Forgotten West Memphis 3, it seemed like it'd be a team effort. A lot of it just comes down to, with that, they have different lawyers that were moving at different speeds. That's what I can say, because I was connected to both and was talking to both. Both are, because some people, Jason had made some tweets and said some things when the hearing was happening that he was upset, that he felt like he was being left behind, that he wasn't being made a part of this, which is understandable, but don't get it twisted. Jason wants testing done. He wants this to get done. He wasn't happy, I think, about the process and how it went forward, that because he wasn't able to be a part of that process. But he was there. He wasn't there at that hearing to say, don't test the evidence. He was there to make sure he was a part of it. But that was what the grasp that I got out of this one was going when the documentary was over. I mean, hell, you guys saw on the documentary, both of them say, yes, let's go test the evidence. They both want it done. Was you had Damien's team that's saying, we need to strike while the iron's hot. There's pressure. Let's move. Let's get this testing done. And then you had Jason's team that was wanting to move slower with it. And there's no requirement for them to be together. And Jason and Jesse will reap the benefits of what Damien is doing, right? So if Damien's testing, if he gets granted the testing and it's done and it yields results that prove who actually did this, that information is in the case file, and that will be able to be used by both Jason and Jesse as well to get their convictions overturned as well. So that's the only reason is when you just have multiple, you've got several different people, several different personalities, several different legal strategies, and several different timelines. In this case, and of course, I'm pretty attached to Damien and his team, but it's because I agreed. Like, we need to not wait 5 years to file this. There's pressure now. Let's go. Let's get it in the books. Let's get it filed. And that's the only difference there, is why they're not, why it's not a team effort, because, Damien just wanted to have the freedom to be able to, pursue the case as he saw fit. And that's what he's doing. And thankfully, with the MVAC method of testing, as we talked about, briefly with Bob and Allie, one of the great things about it is it will not consume all the DNA. When they pull it off, they will save, I think, 2/3 of the DNA collected that'll be preserved for future testing, for if there's better technology that comes along the way. If Jason wants to do something different with any of the technology, that'll still be preserved. Nothing is destroyed using this method. Essentially, think about it like with the old swab method to test for touch DNA. It would be like if I wanted to do a swab of a shirt and test for DNA, and I swabbed it, and then I didn't find anything. Well, somebody else can get another swab and go to try to swab it harder later, right? So the MVAC isn't destroying anything. They can still go in and trying to find new extraction methods and new testing methods later. So with that being said, that's all we got. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Make sure you tune in on Sunday for Rabia Chowdhury and Colin Miller. It was a super cool conversation. We talked about their new up-and-coming reboot of the Undisclosed podcast. That case, we talk a little bit about Adnan. We talk a little bit about the West Memphis 3 case. We talk about the Jason Carroll case. We talk about the Greg Lance case. We just had a really awesome conversation. For those of you that are patrons, you were able to join live today, which is Tuesday when we filmed it. But also, as we do with these, if you're a patron and you didn't catch it live, you can still pop on anytime and watch that episode early. For those of you that aren't patrons, you're still getting the same information. You're still getting the same audio version of it. It's just for the patrons. They can both participate live and then also not just listen, but watch it anytime. From now until forever, it's available on our Patreon. And with that being said, I think that's all I got. You guys got anything else?
Just want to thank Defense Diaries again for being here. They are covering so many cases right now. I can't believe they found the time. So it was very cool to have that voice in here today.
No, it was great. And I'm happy we're moving forward with it. Everybody that listens knows how near and dear this case is to me. So I'm happy we're moving forward.
Awesome. And I do want to share Vesna's post as our last statement here. Free Jamie Snow. It's another case that we can't forget. We got to keep fighting for that. And also free Jesse Eldridge. Let's not forget these cases, and free Sandy Melgar. We can go with all these, but this is proof positive what we're seeing happen right now in the West Memphis 3 case. For those of you that follow Undisclosed or the Jason Carroll or Bone Valley, the Jason Carroll case, the Jason Carroll case that continue fighting, continued pressure, continued attention. Eventually will yield results, so we need to not let off the pressure on any of these cases. With that being said, we will talk to you guys all next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth, Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.